How to control everything with your voice. Is that a Hasselblad in your drone? And all the gaming news from CES coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1678, recorded Friday, January 6th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT.
And by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more.
And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TNT to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase.
Oh, hi.
Welcome to Tech News Today. This is a show where we talk about technology that happened today. And I like to call us the vigilantes. Or vigilantes of tech news.
I've heard you say that so many times. I believe that you like to call us that.
We are. We're the, we're just going to do it. We're going to take this tech news and...
Do our own thing with it, which is like read it a bunch of times and then understand it and then talk about it. Mm-hmm. That's what we do here.
That's what vigilantes
yes,
do.
Exactly.
I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Let's be like true vigilantes and talk about technology in a vigilante sort of way.
Okay.
I don't know what way that is, but there we go.
For the past year or so, we've been lamenting about what to do about all the lax security on routers, cameras, and other Internet of Things devices. The FTC apparently knows what to do. Bring the companies that make insecure products to court. Network World says the Federal Trade Commission is cracking down on D-Link. That's a company that makes routers, smart plugs, security cameras, and baby monitors. They're claiming unfair practices against D-Link. The suit claims D-Link engaged in unfair or deceptive acts and that they failed to take reasonable steps to secure their products, making them vulnerable to hackers. For example, the hard-coded username was often guessed on many of the routers and other devices. The password was also guessed. FTC also alleges that D-Link left a private security code available on a public website for 6 months.
Guessed ID, guessed password.
And hard-coded in there. I don't know if that means like you couldn't change it.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was trying to figure out, too, whether you could actually change it if you really wanted to. And if not, then wow, shame on you. Mm-hmm. FCC actually settled with ASUS in a very similar case earlier last year, or in February of last year. It had an insecure router incident. In 2014, thousands of ASUS router owners suddenly discovered a text file on their devices that basically read, "Your ASUS router and your documents can be accessed by anyone in the world with an internet connection." It just magically appeared there. And so everybody's like, what's going on here? ASUS agreed to maintain comprehensive security measures, things like audits, thanks to the FCC's action with them in the settlement for the next 20 years. Hopefully after 20 years, they continue doing that, but being mindful of that sort of thing. But hey, whatever it takes. I mean, if anything, 2016 has shown us it's that there is a lot of damage that can be done through these insecure devices. And it really just kind of starts at inception. It starts when they're creating the devices, doing things like hard coding guest as an ID and password might have made sense at one time, but I think we're well beyond the point where that makes sense.
Absolutely. Now. And I mean, part of what the FTC is claiming that the company was making claims that it was secure. So it was faulty claims,
right?
Like easy to secure and things like that. You know, I worked for many years writing copy for Microsoft's website in the security area, and we could never say anything was secure. Like we were never supposed to say anything secure
You're making a claim that potentially couldn't be backed up,
right?
Because nothing's 100% secure.
Right. So something could help you secure,
right?
Or, you know, but you would never say that. So I think that, you know, that's where they're getting them. But, you know, the FTC wouldn't just come after someone for the language. And you know, these things were actually not secure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I mean, especially when you're talking about routers, they're the first line of defense for all of these other things in your home. And that's one thing that we're really learning right now. You know, earlier this week we had the Norton, I can't remember the name of the device, but it was a Norton router that kind of had us malware and virus protection built into the router before it ever makes it into the IoT devices that are in your home and into your computers and that sort of stuff. It's scanning at the single point of entry into your home, and that's really what needs to happen here. So if any of the other devices, IoT devices, aren't being made with security in mind, at least hopefully the routers are, and it's imperative that they do. Mm-hmm. Because there's just so much potential for damage, not just in your home, but outside, as we saw with the Mirai botnet and beyond. Samsung's 2016 calendar year seemed at least to be defined by many as the year of exploding Note 7 batteries. It turns out, even in light of all that negative attention, Samsung is projecting record profits in its Q4 2016 earnings. A large part of its success, of course, resides in its chip business, which was unaffected by the whole battery thing, which actually has expected profit of around $3.3 billion. That's helping to offset losses in its mobile arm. Samsung also has a very healthy OLED business. And the projections say Q4 income could be 50% higher than the same period in 2015 and the highest that they've seen since Q3 of 2013, so in the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely the Note 7 fire was a fiasco, fiasco, but nobody died. I mean, there wasn't that much damage. No planes went down. And it really wasn't that bad when you look at the whole, you know, Samsung as a whole and all the other things that they do. The Verge also says the devalued Korean won against the dollar also helped Samsung this year. So, and, you know, we talked about that Chromebook yesterday. I mean, that looks nice, that Samsung Google Chromebook. So, you know, they're not out. They may be a little down. And they're not even down. They're not down, nor are they out.
Well, there are a lot of companies that I think an exploding battery fiasco to the level that the Note 7 saw would have crippled the company. The reason it didn't for Samsung, obviously, is because it's so differentiated. They've got so many different, you know, eggs in their basket that they're playing. Who plays with eggs in baskets? I don't know. But anyways, mixing metaphors. You know what I mean.
You put them in there. You don't play with them.
Yeah, don't shake it because then they'll crack and they'll all explode. But I mean, that's why a company like Samsung is able to weather that storm. I would say as far as like product recalls go, the Note 7 battery fiasco was about as bad as it gets when you're going to airlines. I mean, yes, nobody died. That's the thing that didn't get checkmarked off that list. But that was a massive recall on a really hot product. Dang it, just keeps happening.
But you know,
so it doesn't get any worse than that. It happened to a company that has all sorts of other things going on, and those lines don't seem to cross as much.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder how much of it was just like, it was an easy
joke. Just
people
overreacting to it.
Yeah, you know, it's like, I can never get enough of that hot product joke. It's still funny to me.
Just keeps happening.
Sources tell TechCrunch that Chinese drone maker DJI now owns a majority stake in high-end Swedish camera company Hasselblad, which means your future quadcopter could come with a very fancy camera. DJI has owned a minority stake in Hasselblad since November 2015 in order to appeal to more professional photographers. However, some of those Hasselblad enthusiasts are worried about the future of the iconic camera company that's been around since 1941. So I just enjoy pronouncing Hasselblad.
Hasselblad.
So they haven't been doing so well, as no independent camera companies have been doing so well for a while because of, you know, digital.
Yeah, it's kind of that transition into digital and everything hasn't gone so hot for them. I mean, they even had, most recently, and the only thing that really goes top of mind for me because it crossed into the Android world was the Moto mod for Moto Z, the True Zoom. This one right here that you snap it onto a Moto Z and you've got a Hasselblad camera, you know, to kind of convert your Moto Z into, which looked really neat and altogether, you know, seemed like a really great idea, except the fact that the pictures weren't very good compared to even the stock camera on the phone. So there's a little bit of that, you know, kind of as an example of the kind of their attempts to maneuver this new digital camera world. But at the same time, this is a great deal for both of them, right? Like Hasselblad gets kind of new life through this being attached to arguably one of the industry leaders in its category, DJI. And DJI gets a kind of historically revered name to put on the boxes if they're in fact bringing these camera components and including them into their drones.
Yeah, but I mean, I think of people who love the Hasselblad camera as being, you know, not interested in drones and just sad that their, like, beautiful cameras, you know, might not exist anymore. They might not deliver those, you know, those classic cameras. So, yeah, it's great for the two companies, but for the people, you know, this news hasn't been confirmed by either company.
That's it was important to note.
Yeah, it was posted on a photography blog called Luminous Landscape, which was just someone that, you know, is a photographer, loves these cameras and the company, and, you know, saw a big delay on one of his cameras and, you know, then looked into it and said a lot of people from Hasselblad were saying, yeah, we're now majority owned by DJI.
That was the X1D, I believe, mirrorless compact camera. I guess the costs were really high. The venture firm that had invested in Hasselblad in 2011 wasn't actually willing to put even more money into it. And so Hasselblad reached out to DJI to kind of help get production going. And I think ultimately it'll probably be a good move for both of them if it's ever confirmed someday. Someday we'll see that, I'm sure. This has been the CES that Amazon built, sort of. Alexa is everywhere. I'm pretty sure we've talked about a new product with Alexa capability all week long this week, including coming to soon to some Ford vehicles by way of its Sync 3 technology. Ford drivers will soon be able to use Alexa to control their media, check the weather, control smart home devices while driving. Alexa in the car is what we're talking about here. Vehicles with Sync Connect should receive the capability sometime later. There was an article earlier this week about Alexa being Amazon's OS operating system. This really seems like just a part of that, right? Like in all of these places that we're used to seeing other companies like Google, you know, with Android Auto, taking Android and putting it into the car, with Amazon, it's by way of Alexa skills, and it's permeating quicker than a lot of alternatives like HomeKit and everything.
Absolutely. I bought Echo Dots for my children for Christmas, and one of my children has no interest in it at all. I'm like, well, you can, you know, control your own music, but, you know, she doesn't want it. So I'm thinking of trying to put it in the car. Like, I would need a Wi-Fi hotspot to make it work, but it would connect. It connects with USB, so the power thing would be. I want, if anyone out there has figured out how to make an Echo Dot work in their car, please email me at megan@twit.tv because I want that. I'm not sure why. Like, I need to order like cereal in the car, but I just like the idea of having.
As an Apple user, are you disappointed that Apple has something kind of similar, but it's not seeing the same kind of, I don't know, explosive growth? Like, I feel like Alexa really. Amazon obviously was way ahead of the game, right? 2 years ago, they brought out the Echo. It was a curiosity, but intriguing to people. And then the good reviews started pouring in, and now everybody is kind of doing it. They're all 2 years late, although HomeKit's been around about that long. But so you would expect that, like with Apple's kind of history, they'd be able to tap into their market of Apple users with that product, but it really doesn't seem like it's permeated nearly as strongly as Amazon's.
No, because they have a closed system, because they're stubborn like that. You know, I mean, the reason why Alexa was everywhere at CES is because you can put it in a Ford. You can, you know, put it in all different kinds of devices. They opened it up, you know, and Amazon just said, you know, here, it benefits them to open it up. You know, they're just a very fundamentally different company than Apple. And I'm not just saying like Apple is just being stubborn by closing up there. I mean, it's the way the companies work. They work very differently. It benefits Apple to open it up to people and to spread it that way. I mean, they want people to use Alexa so that they'll buy things from Amazon.
Yeah.
And they, you know, and there's not the same reason. I wish that Siri were better, and I understand some of the reasons why she's not. So yeah, I mean, I don't use Siri really, and that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. There are alternatives. It's just very interesting. I mean, Apple and Google, you know, the two kind of other key players in this industry, are far behind Amazon in this way. And who would have saw that coming 2 years ago?
But I mean,
pretty impressive.
Is Google that far behind? I mean, Home really that far behind the Echo? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I, as a Google Home user, I feel pretty happy with the potential of it. But the thing that Alexa has, and what we've seen especially at CES is just one example, is integration everywhere. You know, Home has plans to open up support for a lot of these other kind of like smart devices and everything. And you can do it in a hacky sort of way with this, if this, then that, and in some instances. But Alexa has the deals. Alexa has the developer mind share of these companies to say, what we need right now with our smart device is some sort of skill that works with Amazon Echo. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely beyond Google Home where it's at right now. Maybe it'll catch up in another year or so, but yeah.
Well, according to regulatory filing, Apple CEO Tim Cook and other Apple executives are taking pay cuts due to the company's lousy year. Now, this is the first time the company has missed sales goals since Cook took over the company, as well as the first miss in the past 15 years. But please do not feel too sorry for Cook. He still earned $8,747,719 last year. That was a lot of dollars. In 2015, it was $10,281,327, and the loss is based on its performance-based cash incentives. So they didn't actually say, like, we're cutting your pay because you did so bad, Tim Cook. It's just, you know, it's based on how well they did, and they did not do as well.
Yeah, so Cook actually did this to himself, apparently, in some of my reading. In 2011, he got 1 million restricted stock units. Those were initially set to vest over time, so just purely time-based. The longer you work here, the more of those that vest over time. In 2013, Cook modified the grant to basically convert a bunch of the units into performance-based awards based on criteria. And in doing so, he also, there's a downside for underperforming, but he made sure to not include extras or some, you know, an additional upside if they overachieve. So basically all it did was mean that as long as Apple stays in the top third of performance metrics compared to competitors, then he would get everything that he was initially supposed to get anyways. And if they do gangbusters even beyond that, he wouldn't get anything extra. If they did in the bottom two thirds, all he would get is less than what he was initially going to get. So, and I think ultimately, they did that to kind of hopefully enhance like their corporate governance and that sort of stuff. But I applaud Tim Cook for that, right? Like that's pretty awesome to kind of, I mean, granted, he's making a lot of money. It doesn't matter how you slice it. So he's got enough to work with there. It's not like, you know, boohoo for Tim Cook.
But he
took a bullet in a certain way to kind of increase the view of the company.
Yes. And I mean, he has also said that he's going to make sure that all his nieces and nephews get through college, and then he's giving the rest of the money away. So like that's what he said. So it's really, I mean, he has more money than he needs to live right now. So it's all those people he was going to give money away to that should feel bad.
Yeah, no kidding.
Up next, Padre caught up with CNET editor-in-chief Lindsay Turrentine at CES. We'll see if they found anything better than a smart hairbrush. But first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, the sponsor of this episode. Now, my family is considering either remodeling our house or selling our house. I asked for some recommendations. A lot of people said, don't remodel. It'll cause stress. It's the worst. But you know what else causes a lot of stress? Working with a mortgage broker. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone that you can trust and who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial information to get a mortgage approval in just minutes. You can even adjust the rate and the length of your loan, and you can do that in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that is exactly right for you. So whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT. Don't forget the TNT. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. It is the last day of CES Las Vegas, and Padre had a chance to speak with one of our favorite editors-in-chief, Lindsay Turrentine from CNET. Let's take a look.
Thanks, Megan. Thanks, Jason. We're here at CES in the South Hall, and look who I just managed to wander across. It's Lindsay Turrentine. Thank you very much for spending time with us. Of course, from CNET, Lindsay, you've had your ear to the ground. You've been looking at the trends. You've been looking at the products. For you, what would be the number one takeaway from CES?
There is a voice control of everything. That's what we're taking away from CES. This is the year, it's really the year of Amazon and Alexa, but lots of other voice control attempts as well. We're seeing voice control in house robots, toasters, because CES, that was the headline that we wrote, toasters, because CES. We're seeing voice control in cars and linking between Alexa as a platform and cars. It's really cool. It's this new layer of communication above the smartphone screen. We kept saying, oh, the smartphone's it. This is how we're going to control everything for the rest of our lives. And it turns out, no, we're getting rid of the screen altogether. And we're just using our voices.
We knew that there was going to be voice control in a lot of things. All the pre-CES releases said, look, we've included a little bit of intelligence, and intelligence is code for an assistant, either Cortana or Google or Alexa. But I was a little taken aback by how much Alexa has ruled. I mean, you do hear about Microsoft's Cortana. You do hear about Google now. But those devices, everything from the toaster to the headphones, they all built on Alexa. Why do you think Amazon has such a leg up in this space?
Well, I think Amazon did two smart things. One, they got started really early. And two, they actually built a piece of hardware that's basically represents Alexa. I mean, you think of Alexa as the AI layer, right? Just like Google Assistant is the AI layer for Google Home. And Siri is really just as sophisticated when it comes to acting as this interface that you can just plug in your iPhone and say, hey, Siri, and make this stuff happen. I'm sorry if I just did that to you. I'm sorry. But Amazon had this physical object that represented what was going on here. And I think it really helped people understand the promise of voice activation. And now there are a lot of people who can't really see the difference between Alexa and the actual Echo device. Now that Alexa is moving into lots of other objects, I actually think that's going to help the rest of the industry, because people are going to start to understand that Alexa is just the operator, and then that'll trickle out to other platforms as well.
There is a theme that's tied to this, and that's the security of the Internet of Things. It has been laughable. The last 2-3 years, we all talk about the Internet of insecure things, or the Internet of owned things, the Internet of hacked things. But what we saw here, at least from companies like ADT and a few of the larger manufacturers, is they're now realizing they suck at security. They're horrible. They don't get security. So they are relying on partners like Amazon or like a third party who does IoT security specifically to give security to their devices. And I'm not sure, do you think that's a good trend or a bad trend to outsource the security section of my connected device?
Okay, well, I think that your devices are only as secure as their weakest partnership, right? So if we have strong partners who can provide that, I actually think that that's a smart thing, because they're going to when you think about those big platform developers, right, the Googles and the Amazons and the Apples, they care so much and they vet so seriously their partnerships. And I think that that's it's a smart move for sure.
All right. I want to talk about something else that we've seen here. Of course, there's the cars. And I know it's a little ad nauseum. We've heard a lot about them, but this has actually been a good year for autonomous vehicles. It's not just this could be a product. It's Ford and Volvo and BMW coming out and saying this is a product. We are working out the last couple of kinks. How close do you think we are to actually having something that someone can go to a dealership and buy and be absolutely secure that it's going to work properly?
I actually think we're there now. I mean, Tesla essentially does this, and it's not completely autonomous, but it essentially is. And I think that as that experience kind of trickles out into the world, people become more accepting of it. So it exists now. I mean, we've got lane sensors on all kinds of cars, and I think that it's just this incremental progress. And the reason that autonomous cars are so successful here is because everybody understands them now. There's a level of comfort. You know, Uber's done a lot of this work out in the industry. I think that, you know, a broad spectrum of drivers aren't going to be completely comfortable with it yet, but they kind of, it's just sneaking in, and auto manufacturers, mainstream ones like Ford, are now ready to just take advantage of that.
Let's talk a little bit about Ford, because we stopped by their booth yesterday. We had a very nice conversation with a man who you could say is the father of their autonomous or assisted driving division. And what he was saying was Ford absolutely will have a car ready by 2021. So they know it's going to go to market. They've got the hardware. They know the hardware configuration that they want. And it actually looked good. It didn't look space age. There wasn't a big hat sitting on top of the car. And he said, no, it's just a matter of us getting to the point that automakers feel comfortable with releasing this into the world. And it brings up this interesting point, because there's this influx of money from VC coming into Silicon Valley for all the companies who want to get into autonomous driving. And yet, there are companies like Ford, the established players, who say, you know you're making a car, right? You can't just release it and have a couple of crashes and say, well, that was beta, and fix it. Do you think that disconnect between Silicon Valley and old Detroit is going to become more pronounced as the autonomous car trend continues?
I actually think most of the major manufacturers have R&D outfits in Silicon Valley. Not to make too fine a point of it, but that thinking and that there's sort of this industry level collaboration about how this is going to work, and there's a need for that because there's a policy level to this, right? So I actually think that the established manufacturers are pretty far into this game. I think that they have a huge leg up because they, like you said, they make cars. And I think that they're going to continue to dominate. And then, and in a way, the new manufacturers or the startup-y kind of car companies are adding a layer of flash and excitement that gets people's attention and is actually ultimately helping the major manufacturers market their vehicles.
Okay, well, one last bit, and this goes hands in hand with that autonomous car story. That is BMW at their booth. They have the connected experience. And the whole idea is they sat their engineers down. They said, okay, like you, they think, we've got this autonomous car thing. We know how to make it work. Maybe there's a couple of software tweaks we have to make. But now the question becomes, what do you do when you're in your car that's driving itself? And so they've created this experience that you can get the same information, the same cloud-connected data in your car, in your home, in your office, on your watch, on your phone. Is that the next big thing that goes hand in hand with autonomous vehicles? In other words, once we're autonomous, how do I occupy my time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that that's happening now, right? I mean, you see a lot of cars with connectivity. And if you've watched anybody under the age of 20 navigate their day, their expectation is of entertainment and connectivity at any moment of the day. And I sound really old because, you know, for generations, people have been saying kids these days expect to be entertained. Maybe it's not so much entertained as connected. The expectation of connection is there. And I think that it will be less jarring than we think to find something to do in the car, because as passengers, we've already been doing that. And now it's just sort of, well, okay, the expectation is you're essentially a passenger all the time.
Lindsay, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you
for being part of TNT. Of course, they see you on the Twit Network all the time. You are a frequent guest. But if they wanted to find your work here at CNET, where should they go?
You can follow me at @LTurrentine on Twitter. And, of course, come to CNET.com because we've got stuff going on here every second of the day.
That's Lindsay Turrentine. I'm Father Robert Valliser. And if you want to see the rest of the Twit coverage of CES 2017, be sure to go to twit.tv/specials. Megan, Jason, back to you.
So I should correct myself. I said CES over, and that's because I wanted it to be over. But it's actually not over if you're watching this live. It's not over till Sunday.
Yeah, don't worry. It's over for you once we're at the end of this show.
It's all over. It's just, I don't love it. There's a bunch of stuff that comes at you, you know, and stuff isn't coming out yet. And it's, you know, everything's a concept. Yeah. And it just feels like there's this, and maybe I'm just jealous because I'm not in Las Vegas.
I mean, and I guess that's one of the upsides of actually being there for CES, is because even though all of this stuff is merely just being announced, teased, kind of shown off, but not releasing for a long time, if you're there, in many cases, you actually get a chance to interact with it or play with it or see it or whatever. For those of us that aren't there, it ends up being this kind of like looking forward into the future. What can we expect 7-8 months down the line, or even 2-5 years down the line? It becomes a little bit more esoteric in that regard.
Right. Well, it's also, you get all these, you know, CES pitches, like you get them in the mail constantly. Yeah. And then you just kind of, you tend to see like the overworkings of it. It's like there's all these people just trying to push their products.
Yeah.
And
there's the most important message to get to you.
And so, and then you start to hear, when you're reading the coverage, you start to hear like the same things reported that are in those, you know, PR sheets. And it just feels like there's, I don't know, there's a lot, there's definitely some useful stuff, but there's a lot of useless stuff, except for that hairbrush that listens to your hair. That is awesome.
Or the laptop with 3 screens. That's awesome.
Now, as Padre said, go to twit.tv/specials to see all his work. He'll also be showing some of his CES finds on know-how next week.
Excellent. Thanks for all the coverage from the crew all week. for TNT. We really appreciate it. Phil wrote to us about our discussion a while back on bezel-less phones. He says, as an owner of the Galaxy S7 Edge, it is virtually impossible for me to use this phone without some kind of phone case. Albeit without a phone case, I do risk the possibility of shattering either the front, back, or both. With the curved edges, I unintentionally launch apps, go to screens that I did not intend to go to, and perform other random tasks that I did not intend. I don't know if you consider the S7 Edge bezel-less or not. I think I kind of do. Seems to me there would have been some sort of bumper or rejection of some sort. I'm curious to know what performance others have from bezel-less phones like Jason's Pixel, which, I mean, I don't know if I necessarily consider this bezel-less. I mean, on the sides, I understand what he's saying. It's a minimal bezel on the side. I actually have a case on my phone, so I guess I wouldn't run into those issues as much, like little phantom touches on the edges, because the case really kind of rounds around it, and I don't experience that. I did, however, experience that on the Edge. In my time with the S7 Edge, yeah, there's just, I mean, and especially because Samsung puts stuff there to be kind of launch points for certain things, depending on what mode you're in. In the OS. So, I mean, if you're just merely holding the phone in your hand the way you normally would, if you don't have a case on it, sometimes that can, you know, your thumb can kind of fold over and kick off into something. I view that as the one of the bigger downsides of a bezel-less design. You know, people want it. Ron Richards, of course, he was on earlier this week saying it's the future. It's what sci-fi always has, is like this sheet of glass, and I want the future and everything. And I mean, they just have to master rejection, like unintended, you know, touch rejection, and I'm sure they'll get there. Because if there is no bezel to grab onto, then yeah, guaranteed your hand is going to get in the way, just merely by holding it.
Well, you could hold it like that, right? And it would never fall out of your hand either. That's what you see.
It would never fall out of your hand. That would be a nice trick,
right? I mean, not. I know I haven't mentioned Westworld in a while, but they do have the devices. They just hold like this, and they have no bezel, and they're just like
like magnetically snapped to your hand. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They know how to just okay. Mm-hmm. All right, stand correct. Sounds good to me. Coming up, a good amount of gaming news happened this week at the Consumer Electronics Show, and Sam Moskovich will chat a little bit about what stood out to him. But first, let's take a minute to thank Epson. They are the sponsor of this episode. Epson's revolutionary cartridge-free EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. You can see the beast right there. It's the EcoTank ET4550. It's a wireless all-in-one printer. It doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features this awesome refillable ink tank that you're seeing there, earning it the title of CES 2016's Innovation Awards honoree. So you're not going to get frustrated with your ink. No more frustration kind of having to find the cartridge and plug it in and all that kind of stuff. Here, you get up to 2 years of ink equal to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. You can actually save up to 80% on ink with low-cost replacement bottles. It's powered by Precision Core printing technology. It has auto two-sided printing and a 30-page auto document feeder. Easy wireless printing from your tablets, your mobile devices, your smartphones, all that kind of stuff, which is normally a difficult task. Here, not so. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value. With Epson's EcoTank line of printers, you will have the freedom to print without running out of ink. The Epson EcoTank system was also named the 2016 Small Biz Windows Printer of the Year. So visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or workgroup prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the Epson EcoTank printers. That's EPSON.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson for their support. Our time with CES might be coming to a close, but surely we've missed some stuff. In fact, I know we have. Sam Moskovich from Ars Technica is here to tell us what we have missed. Welcome, Sam.
When I'm not playing with crazy laptops with three screens, I make my time to show you and talk to you about everything else that might have been at CES.
But you wanted that laptop with with three screens, right?
Oh, God. We could lose the whole segment to that. Let's move on. Hurry up.
Wait, but did you see it move? Did you see the robot arms open and close? Or was it not working?
Listen. I've already put in my pre-orders for... And you can't... I don't think you even can put in a pre-order. I just sent my money to some guy in Nigeria. That thing looks incredible.
Excellent. That's what we'd hope.
You sent it straight to Valerie.
Yes.
All right. So how about we start off, aside from the three-screen laptop, with the HTC announcements. Vive, of course, had some hardware announcements. Cool little tracker, which I think you could do a lot with. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. HTC, as we all know, is mostly tanking as a company, but its Vive division got spun off at some point last year because they realized there was money and potential in it. They were selling enough of these overpriced virtual reality kits to make that work. So we expected something from HTC Vive at CES, but we didn't know whether we'd get a Vive 2.0 or something really tiny. What we did end up with, the biggest thing may be the tracker. This is a little peripheral that you can attach to all kinds of different stuff. You could attach it to a golf club or a tennis racket. They even suggested perhaps useful things like fire hose training. Like, you could essentially create simulators with real world objects, attach a little tracker to it, and then that real world object, when you're holding it and then you're wearing the virtual reality kit, would translate almost perfectly to the virtual world. That's going to be, I can't remember exactly how much those are going to be priced at, but those are definitely going to be targeting a different range of consumer, certainly in the early going. I imagine they're going to be going for more of these, for example, fire station training, that sort of thing. So that could be really interesting. And there isn't an equivalent from any other virtual reality company. So HTC made a really smart move there with that one. For the home market, there's a couple of other things. First off, the TP-Cast is finally going to get a more major rollout. This is the wireless thing that we've all been waiting for. The ability to put on a Vive headset without the giant, almost Battlefield Earth-like set of cables draping behind you. You'll be able to either plug this into a wall, which would make it still be wired, or you can attach a battery, which will supposedly have about an hour and a half life. But either way, this is less cabling, less annoyance, and only, they're saying, a tiny bit of latency added, as in 2 extra milliseconds between your computer rendering the stuff and it appearing in your eyeballs. And keeping that time of rendering between the computer and your eyes low is super important. Otherwise, it doesn't feel like you're actually hanging out with a whale. That extra little spaciness, you know, when you want the most immersive whale time, you want to get that right. And last up was they're going to do a ear strap. It's going to have a strap change because the Vive headset, just thinking about how uncomfortable the Vive headset is normally gets me frustrated. And I'm really happy that they're going to improve this with essentially a whole new strap. You're going to take the headset off and put a whole new strap on. I think it's going to be about $250. And it's going to have headphones embedded so that you don't have to take your own headphones and plug them in. And it's going to move some of the strap bulkiness to a different spot of your head to essentially have the whole thing rest on your head in a more comfortable way. That's probably our biggest complaint about the HTC Vive and one of the biggest reasons why Oculus is slightly more preferred, because this strap is just better at situating the weight on your head. So none of these are about a new screen or a lower price in general. These are all mostly things that are targeting people who might have already bought a Vive. But it does set the table for essentially a 2.0 Vive with perhaps a better screen or a lower price or a nicer package. It's all making it clear that HTC is not going away. They're not giving up on VR just yet.
Yeah, that was kind of what my follow-up question was going to be about, is kind of like, we don't know the lifespan of VR headsets at this point, right? Like, we know with consoles, however many years we're going to get out of a console, at least based on historically how long those consoles are around before they decide they need to re-up them. But I mean, with these headsets, obviously they've really only been around for about a year in consumer hands, if not less than that. I mean, does this signal like a 2 to 3 year, like, is there any indication as far as like what this points to in that regard?
You know, I talked about this in our Ars Technica had a best of VR in 2016. And my call is, last year was sort of the year that we found out that VR actually works, that people will buy it, that you can put it out in the consumer market at a affordable price, if you know $800 is affordable to you. But people are, you know, tens of thousands of people is enough to keep this business going. And there's content. So you can actually buy a VR headset and have things to do. Right. But this year is the year that I think sales have to go up. And discounts have to come in. There has to be more bundling. There has to be more drastic price drops if VR is going to make it out of 2017 alive. Otherwise, developers aren't making money. If you want to make a video game or an app for VR, right now you're selling to very few people who don't necessarily have that much more money to throw. They threw their $800 at the hardware. It doesn't mean that they have another $50 to $60 per app. That's a lot to ask for. So the prices have to come down. The bundling and the packages have to come up. I really think that by March, we're going to get sort of Oculus, Sony, Vive, maybe other companies coming in and saying, hey, $500 for everything, headset, compatible hardware, et cetera. That's, without something like that, something drastic, I don't see it really being anything in the, for the full year. Like someone like me, I'm into it, but
right.
I'm not enough.
Yeah, that's the difference. I think there are a lot of people waiting on the sideline. The cost of it at this point, and kind of some of the built-in complexity of buying a compatible system, you know, to hook it up to and all that kind of stuff. I've been waiting on the sideline because that isn't quite yet, but they're very intrigued and they're ready when the price is right. I think you're absolutely spot on with that. And I hope that happens because that'll probably be when I jump for it as well. Now, we discussed the new NVIDIA Shield unit earlier this week, but missed the news around NVIDIA's new and improved GeForce Now service. What's to know there?
GeForce Now is a continuation of GeForce and NVIDIA's service to stream games to players. The idea being that it's like some of these others, in particular PlayStation Now, where you log in and there's a server farm running your game. With those, you end up paying a monthly fee, but NVIDIA is going a different route. They're saying, pay us a certain amount of money and we'll give you a certain number of hours to play. Right now, they're looking at $25, which will let you play for 20 hours on a computer sitting in a server farm with a GTX 1060 video card. That video card's relatively affordable. You only have to pay about for eight of those chunks, about 160 hours, before you're paying essentially for a 1060. That money will also let you play for 10 hours on a 1080. PC. It's a weird pricing scheme where they're essentially saying, throw $20-$25 at us and we'll sort of see how powerful a computer you could get. It definitely seems more like a sales pitch to, you know, buy into their hardware than it is a fully working cloud system. I don't know about y'all, but I feel like I left paying by the hour for internet service behind in the 90s. You know, This is very AOL CompuServe. I don't quite get where they're going with this, especially since the market has made it clear the monthly subscription service works. Netflix, Hulu, HBO, that's where it's at. And I think it's a really weird call on NVIDIA's part to do this. I honestly think that they did this because they left a certain thing unannounced. The 1080 Ti. We were all hoping that NVIDIA would come out and say, all right, we've put out these 1080, 1070, 1060. That's, you know, their number scheme. But the Ti is sort of this cream of the crop, super overclocked, but affordable, powerful video card. They always do this for each of their classes. The 980 Ti came out a couple of years ago and just was an amazing value proposition in terms of power for the money. And we're waiting for that one. But the problem is NVIDIA's still at the top. There's only two companies doing these really expensive video cards right now. It's NVIDIA and AMD. AMD still has yet to really catch up and make that kind of splash that's challenging NVIDIA. And that's why you end up with more boring press conferences where they're like, here's a streaming service where we charge you kind of by the hour. Oh, and we're going to do smart cars, even though there's companies that are way ahead of us in the smart car game and stuff like that. I kind of wonder. They seem a little too comfortable at the top, if you ask me.
So this was eagerly announced. I mean, in doing my reading, it seemed like a lot of people were really disappointed to not see some sort of announcement about this. What now? Like, is this obviously on the horizon, or, I mean, next year, or what do you think?
I think NVIDIA now just looks at the sales data and says, this is how many months we get to wait until we introduce the next thing to spur sales.
Right.
AMD is just not challenging them, and they're trying. They're trying to get FreeSync, which is their proprietary monitor refresh technology, this sort of variable refresh. I could go down in the weeds with that. It is pretty cool. But people aren't really biting on that. They're not really biting on the DirectX 12 related things. That's sort of Microsoft's efficiency push, and AMD has had a little bit of better results with that, but not enough to really make people buy the things in droves. AMD is not competing enough. NVIDIA's sitting on its laurels, and I don't blame them. If I was also in a comfortable lead and got to kind of milk the market for whenever and however I wanted, I'd do it too. So it's a shame. AMD really needs to step things up to excite someone like me. For now, they're doing fine.
Right. Competition is good for that very reason. Also teased during the NVIDIA press event was Mass Effect Andromeda, which had been delayed originally from its original 2016 launch to sometime this year. What are the new details on that release?
We're finally going to get it this year. We have an actual announcement date of coming out on March 21st in the United States on Windows. I believe it's Windows 8 or 9. They don't lock things into Windows 10 like Microsoft does, along with PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. 2 days later in Europe, it did get pushed back. We wondered why that was. My guess, honestly, is that EA had so much stuff coming out this holiday season. In fact, they threw out a really good game, Titanfall 2, that just got it fell behind because they launched it pretty much at the same time as Battlefield 1. But we're getting a little bit more gameplay teasing here and there. We're not learning a ton about this game because the Mass Effect series and all of these BioWare games have always been about relationships. And that's a really hard thing for the BioWare team to really tease in short trailers. We're getting a lot of these looks at the open world nature of the game. It looks to be that the dialogue and the plot stuff is going to be in a more open world way where it's attached to quests, as opposed to a lot of these longer narrative hub city sort of things that the older BioWare games did so well. So we're going to have to wait until March to really see how that narrative stuff that we love so much in a BioWare game works with this increased emphasis on open world action. But I mean, it looks good, and NVIDIA really was taking advantage of that to say, hey, better on NVIDIA. If you're going to play it on PC, enjoy that hardware.
Yeah, right. Now, finally, it sounds like there's something to look forward to next week, right around the corner. Suddenly, I feel like I blink, and Nintendo's Switch event is right around the corner. Will you be covering that?
Oh, you better believe it. Sorry, I was doing my Mr. Burns thing for like a year. Yes, the Nintendo Switch event coming on January 12th. That is in 6 days. Keep your Santa Claus letters ready for that. And we're getting closer to that full. It's going to be, we expect an announcement of a release date. We expect the announcement of which games are going to be coming on it. And we're getting closer to finding out what games will be coming. We're hearing reports that the game Beyond Good and Evil 2, a sequel to a fan favorite but didn't sell a lot by Ubisoft from years ago, will land on the Switch, the Nintendo Switch, maybe at launch, maybe later this year. It'll be a Switch exclusive for some time. Nintendo is helping develop it, is the rumor. We don't know that for 100% sure. We're also hearing possible news that The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild will be a launch game. That is not 100% confirmed, but Eurogamer has a report that makes clear that Nintendo has worked overtime to have that be the big surprise of January 12th, that this Zelda game that they kind of teased as coming later in 2017, surprise, it's done, it's ready to rock, and it'll be out in March alongside a new Mario game and some other ports. So we're hearing that the game Splatoon, which was it debuted on the Wii U as an online shooting game, very cute, colorful, kid-friendly online shooter, that should be receiving a Nintendo Switch update that could come out on the launch date in March. We're also hearing that Mario Kart is very likely. There was that Switch kind of commercial that showed Mario Kart, so it's not surprising that a Mario Kart game would land day and date with the Switch. And that there's a 3D Mario adventure game that apparently has been worked on for some time, might have come out on the Wii U, but they've held it so that it can also be a Switch debut game. Now, that's kind of insane. Nintendo has never launched both a brand new Zelda game and a brand new Super Mario game for a system at the same time. Never happened. Not the NES, not the Super Nintendo, N64, GameCube, Wii, Wii U. If that really does happen, people are just going to be freaking out because Nintendo needs that. They really need people to come in to be excited from day one, because otherwise the third parties, these extra companies like EA and Ubisoft, all these big companies that don't make games for Nintendo are going to continue not doing so. If gamers aren't showing up on the first day, buying it and wanting to stick around and buy more games, that's not happening. So if those companies really do get on board, and if Nintendo can show off that the system is powerful enough to run really good-looking modern Zelda and Mario games, then there's hope. Nintendo has a lot at stake here.
Sure.
So I'm glad that they changed the promotional material a little bit for the Switch. The last videos that we saw had someone like taking out the Switch at a cocktail party or something and like playing amongst themselves or like a rooftop party or something. And this one makes more sense. It's like people playing on a plane, playing, you know, in a car. I'm still surprised that you're so excited about this. I mean, where do you imagine just like taking this with you wherever you go, or do you imagine you'll mostly be playing in your living room?
So I think the most exciting thing for me is that Nintendo is saying we're officially done with the era of a portable system and a home system, that a game for this one isn't going to work on that one and vice versa. I think that's the biggest thing Nintendo has here, is their chance to say, we make a pretty good Game Boy, we make a pretty good home system, let's take these things we're good at and combine them so that when you buy one, you essentially get both. The problem, of course, is that to be powerful enough, or I'm sorry, to work portably, it can't be so powerful. It's got to manage battery life. And that's been the news over the past few weeks, is that it's just not that powerful a system when you're running in portable mode. In fact, that it downclocks the processor speed is sort of this developer leak that we've heard about. Eurogamer has actually been really good with these Nintendo stories. I don't know who their source is, but God bless them. So I think that the question really is, what can Nintendo do with a lower powered system? And will that portable mode, home mode combination entrance gamers? And the answer, honestly, is if Nintendo can really blow us away with that Nintendo magic, if they give us that good Mario Kart, that good Zelda, that good Mario right from the gate, out of the gate, gamers will show up. They've done that even for their crappier systems. People did buy the Wii U until they realized there would be no really good Super Nintendo or Super Mario or Zelda game. Getting those old good series right. And by the way, that new Zelda game looks really new in terms of doing things Zelda games haven't done before. It feels more modern from what we played at E3 this past summer. It feels more like a really modern quest game, more open-ended, more exciting. So that's good news. So I'm hopeful, but Nintendo has really done a better job disappointing me than blowing me away in the past few years. So it remains to be seen, but I'm remaining optimistic for what we come to see in 6 days.
Excellent. So am I. That's Friday, January 13th is the big announcement. And
Thursday, January 12th. You would have slept through that.
The games are announced on Friday. The Switch is announced on
there
the 12th.
They're going to be doing a trickle. There's going to be a broadcast on the 12th, and then there's going to be events around the world the following days. So that Thursday through Friday through Saturday, stay glued to any screen you have for more information.
With super glue.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else. Appreciate all of your insight here, Sam Moskovich from Ars Technica. Always love getting you on the show. Thanks again. Appreciate
it. Yes, let's talk next week about Nintendo. Why not?
I think we might have something to talk about. Mm-hmm. We'll talk to you soon. Have a great weekend. Bye. Yeah.
TNT's fan of the day is Andrea M. on Twitter, who sent us this picture of his coding environment, and it includes Tech News Today.
Of course it does. Like any good coding environment, mm-hmm. there should be a window dedicated to TNT.
That is some good concentration to be able to watch and listen and code at the same time. I am impressed. We would love to see how you watch or listen to TNT. Again, if you get that little... knocked over my coffee almost. Got so excited. If you get the robot arm PC, we want to see you watching TNT on it. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup, post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we will find it. After the break, self-driving motorcycles could be in our future, but first, Let's take a minute to thank Tracker, the sponsor of this episode. Now, we all lose our stuff. We do. Admit it. I know you do. I do. I can admit it. Newsweek reports that the average American wastes 55 minutes a day looking for things they own but cannot find. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past, and I will tell you how to get one for free. The Tracker Bravo locates misplaced keys, wallets, luggage, instruments, bicycles, electronic devices, even pets in seconds. If you have some AirPods, put that on that little floss box and then you'll be able to find your box when you lose it. The coin-sized device is constructed with anodized aluminum for the thinnest, most durable tracking. You can easily attach it to your items with a key loop or the adhesive that comes with it. Tracker is enabled by Bluetooth LE, so the battery will last you up to a year. You can add a laser engraved message to each Tracker Bravo, like return information or your pet's name if you have it on your pet. You can now personalize your tracker with a custom printed image. Pair Tracker to your iOS or your Android device and find its precise location with a tap of a button. It is that easy. Your phone can track up to 10 devices at once, and you can customize two-way separation alerts so you're notified before you leave your item behind. If you lose your phone, press the button on the tracker, and then your phone will ring even if it's on silent. There are over 3.5 million devices, so that means the tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world. So your lost item will show up on a map, even if it's miles away. If you lose your item, the tracker app records its last known location on a map. Then when another tracker user comes within a 100-foot range of your item, you will get a GPS update of where your item is located. Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Plus, just for you, just for our audience, if you enter promo code TNT, you will get a free Tracker Bravo with your order. That's thetracker.com, promo code TNT to get your free Tracker Bravo today. If you have ever wanted to ride a motorcycle, but you're afraid of losing your balance and being crushed in the road by 900 pounds of machinery, I've got good news for you. At CES this week, Honda showed off a self-balancing motorcycle that looks magical. The technology comes from the same balancing tech used in Honda's Asimo robot. According to Popular Mechanics, the bike increases the fork angle, which lengthens the bike's wheelbase and then disconnects the front forks from the handlebars.
Of course it does.
Then the system uses minute steering inputs to keep the bike balanced. No kickstand needed.
Maybe the same could be said about cars, with autonomous cars that taking the fun out of it. Mm-hmm. But I have to imagine it goes tenfold for riding a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Like getting on a motorcycle and then just letting it ride, drive you around everywhere. I don't know. But I'm actually surprised it took this long, to be honest. I mean, we've had Segways, you know, like this whole balancing technology that we've seen become, you know, in larger and larger formats. Mm-hmm. Has been around for a little while. So I'm actually kind of surprised we haven't seen this in motorcycles. It seems like a perfect fit.
I think that last year at CES, they showed off something similar. The Honda didn't, but somebody else showed off something similar. So it has been around. It's not really self-driving. It's just really self-balancing.
Yeah.
It won't go, you know, you can't just program in the, you know, the GPS that you want to go somewhere. But,
but you know that's, well, I don't know. It's following her. She's walking along and
yeah,
that's
CES crazy. For you. They're fooling you into thinking that science it's fully autonomous. Fiction. But you're right. Real bikers would never ride an autonomous bike.
They're like eating Chinese food with chopsticks while their motorcycle's driving them down the freeway.
Reading a novel. That's what I would do on my autonomous motorcycle.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, this is a strange future that we're about to live in.
Mm-hmm.
It's already pretty strange. Mm-hmm. Real quick, before we go, we heard from many people who wanted a Twit store, and we have it. It's here. The new Twit store is open. You can check out new designs, all of them made by Anthony Nielsen, who is our technical director today. So bravo for that. We brought back some popular favorites that were kind of limited time offerings. Now they're here again. So you have another chance at those. We'll be adding show specific gear and new designs every week. Visit twit.tv/store to get in on the action there. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. Be part of the show by emailing us, tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW, and find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsTodayTV.
If you want to subscribe to the show, go to twit.tv/TNT. Whatever device you're using, however you want to subscribe, we will show you how right there on that page. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Anthony, of course, and artiste,
resident artiste. Thanks to Mario for helping out here in the studio. Thanks to Kevin for editing. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you all on Monday. Have a great weekend. Bye.